Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And this is James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com, and we welcome you to the 80th episode of New World Next Week, which, of course, you can find on NewWorldNextWeek.com. High-quality, low-quality video, audio only. And, of course, we haven't mentioned it lately, but huge thanks to ParadigmShift.tv, who gets this show broadcast abroad on Sky Satellite Channel 201. James, so very much to get to on this episode, so we'll get right to it with an excellent article written by Shoestring on 911blogger.com, and it's well-sourced and well-documented. The 9/11 hijackers, amateur aviators who became super pilots on 9/11. In the days after 9/11, numerous pilots and aviation experts commented on the elaborate maneuvers performed by the aircraft in the terrorist attacks and the advanced skills that would have been necessary to navigate those aircraft into their targets. The men flying the planes must have been highly skilled pilots and extremely knowledgeable and capable aviators who were probably military trained, these experts said. And yet the four alleged hijackers who were supposedly flying the aircraft were amateur pilots who had learned to fly in small propeller planes and were described by their instructors as having only average or even very poor piloting skills. But on their first attempt at flying jet aircraft on 9/11/01, these men were supposedly able to fly Boeing 757s and 767s at altitudes of tens of thousands of feet without any assistance from air traffic control. Three of them were apparently able to successfully navigate their planes all the way to their intended targets, which they hit with pinpoint accuracy. For such poor pilots to carry out such skilled flying would surely have been extremely unlikely, perhaps impossible. And yet, this is what is claimed in the official account of 9/11. Numerous experts commented that the hijackers who flew the aircraft in the 9/11 attacks must have been highly trained and skillful pilots. Tony Ferrante, the head of the Federal Aviation Administration's Investigations Division, spent several days after 9/11 carefully piecing together the movements of the four aircraft targeted in the attacks. According to author Pamela Frenny, Ferrante's hair stood on end when he realized the precision with which all four airplanes had moved towards their targets. Ferrante said, quote, "It was almost as though it was choreographed. It's not as easy as it looks to do what the hijackers did at 500 miles an hour," end quote. John Roden, the president of Aviation Advisory Service, an Oakland, California consulting firm, said the piloting necessary to navigate the planes to their targets, quote, "was very skillful. This is practically fighter pilot technique," end quote. And a U.S. Air Force officer who flew over 100 sorties during the Vietnam War concluded that the hijacked aircraft, quote, "either had a crack fighter pilot in the left seat or they were being maneuvered by remote control," end quote. James, I'll throw it back to you, and then we'll wrap it up with some unbelievable related 9/11 updates.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely incredible article. I really hope people will go and check the link on this one and read it for themselves, because it has just quote after quote after quote from various experts basically displaying the fact that it must have been extremely crack-level fighter pilots, or it was remote control that was able to do these incredible maneuvers on 9/11. And it's important for people to really think about the types of maneuvers that were going on. And one place for starting to think about that is the interview that I did with Aidan Monahan a few months ago about a research article he did about the World Trade Center 1 and 2 attacks, and the way the planes came in on banked curves that ended exactly level with the buildings, which is something that you don't think about. You think it's very easy to steer something like a plane into a building, but it's actually extremely difficult to do, and to do it on a perfect banked curve to come exactly level with the building is almost impossible. I mean, it would take incredible amounts of planning or some type of autopilot, and that's the thing that we have to start looking at. And then the Flight 77 doing its 270-degree corkscrew spiral turn, descending through 8,000 feet in 2.5 minutes to come exactly level with the ground and hit the Pentagon in the budget analyst office that was working on the missing $2.3 trillion. No, nothing suspicious about that. No, this is another one of the smoking guns of 9/11. It's equally as important as the demolitions and the stand down and all of the other things that point to inside job. And I think people should start concentrating more on this angle, because it's an extremely important angle to what was going on that day, and it obliterates the idea of that's being put out right now. There's a limited hangout idea being put out that Saudi Arabia was funding the hijackers, and therefore, you know, there was a cover up of the Saudi connection, and that limited hangout is being put out right now. But we have to look through that and look past that, because there was a legend being created about these hijackers, and these hijackers were not who they appeared to be. And I would direct people to the incredible, excellent work of Daniel Hopsicker on the Venice Flying Circle and all of the crazy things surrounding these supposed Muslim extremists who were living with strippers and doing cocaine and drinking alcohol. I mean, these were not religious fundamentalists. So a lot of things to think about, but again, please go and read this article. And I'd just like to let people know that I'm going on a summer hiatus starting next week, but when I get back, it's going to be all 9/11. It's going to be 9/11 for the whole month leading up to the 10th anniversary. So we're going to be covering things like this and the other smoking guns of 9/11. So please stay tuned for that.
Because, James, this is the event that woke, I know, you and I up and countless millions of other people to these kind of stories that go on generation after generation, that as time goes by, everybody kind of tacitly thinks, oh, well, yeah, there was probably something else going on, or we were probably lied to, but they don't take the time to dig in. Yeah, we're less than 2 months away from the 10th anniversary. A couple of those unbelievable related updates I'll quickly mention from the Christian Science Monitor. Bush should face criminal probe over post-9/11 torture, report urges. And this amazing one from The Guardian. CIA organized fake vaccination drive to get Osama bin Laden's family DNA. And lastly, from the New York Daily News, Panetta ties war in Iraq to 9/11. Panetta, of course, coming from the CIA to now head the DOD, and of course Petraeus going from DOD to CIA, and it's all a big, happy, revolving door family. James, our second story is quite hot here in the States, and we'll take it just briefly from Reuters. People really hate the Netflix price hike. Subscribers have been up in arms since Netflix announced a changed pricing structure on Tuesday, that's yesterday to me, July 12th, that will raise the price for a combined DVD and streaming subscription from $10 to $16 a month. The company is also offering DVD-only and streaming-only subscriptions for $8 a month, but most people don't seem to like the prospect of having to choose. The Netflix blog has seen more than 4,200 comments, and it's way more than that by this point, most of which are negative, with a number of customers threatening to cancel. Countless customers have also turned to the company's Facebook page, which now has tens of thousands of negative comments. Negative feedback far outweighing any other kind of response, and on Twitter, the discussion around the plan changes has made DVDs an unlikely trending topic in a number of cities. What does all this uproar mean for Netflix? Of course, it's unlikely that any price increase would be met with a thumbs up by many consumers. However, the intensity of the backlash seems to suggest that Netflix really does have a problem. Netflix has long enjoyed a lot of goodwill from its customers simply due to the breadth of its DVD offering. Consumers tolerated the lack of selection in the company's streaming catalog because it was seen as a value add to their existing DVD subscription. Recent hiccups, such as Sony removing titles from the streaming catalog, also didn't lead to many complaints. However, with streaming and DVDs effectively being separated from each other and users being forced to pay twice as much, many customers are seemingly losing their patience with Netflix. The company may have to go back and do a better job at explaining these changes, or even unveil some great new streaming catalog additions before the September 1st deadline that will force people to pay more, choose between streaming or DVDs, or cancel altogether. Now, James, you guys don't have access to Netflix in Japan, I believe.
That's right. So you're going to have to help me out with this story, because I'm not sure what type of price range increase we're talking about here.
It's basically a 60% increase. So personally, what I have, the subscription, we have, of course, unlimited streaming. And then I personally have a DVD coming one at a time, as many as I can go through. And my girlfriend, she has her own DVD queue. So ultimately, we've already talked about this, and we're probably going to dump one of the DVD queues. There's a number of interesting tie-ins to this. I think that, one, their name is Netflix. It's not Mailflix. So this kind of shouldn't come as a surprise. And I think this was kind of part of their scheme, you know, all along. And now Blockbuster and other places have popped up to say, oh, you know, don't forget about us. You know, we're still here. But is this also a matter of just, you know, getting people hooked on something at the lower price, or, you know, giving that little bit away for free, and then we get you hooked, and then we're going to really, really gouge you.
Well, that would seem to be the case, wouldn't it? And so I guess people will have to vote with their pocketbooks whether or not it's worth continuing. But I understand that you've been doing work to help people who are Netflix subscribers to wade through the morass of information that they have access to.
Mm-hmm. Myself and Paul Verge of Divergent Films, of course, the guy behind Believers Beware and Hijacking Humanity, and also Richard Grove and Lisa Arbacheski and other folks of TragedyAndHope.com, they start find sort of diamonds in the rough in the mass amounts of film and documentaries and shows and all these things that are available on Netflix. So navigatingnetflix.com is the site. I built it myself and tried to mock up, you know, make it look like the Netflix site. The idea of it being a sort of movie review show with a conscience. So our pilot episode is up, and it's called The Experiment. And it's about a dramatization film with Adrian Brody and Forrest Whitaker, but it's really about the Stanford Prison Experiment. So we're able to discuss the film, but also get at some of the deeper issues and touch on the supplemental and contextual information that folks might not be aware of. I am anxiously awaiting the publication of episode 2, featuring Mike Judge's 2006 underground, already cult classic, Idiocracy. So once again, I'll implore folks to check out navigatingnetflix.com.
Right. Well, I have taken a look at the first one and really enjoyed it, even though I had not seen the movie. So I suggest people do take a look at it, as it's quite a thorough breakdown of what's going on. And absolutely. And you've got the next episodes lined up there on the site, so people can check them out before they come up, so that they have a chance to pre-screen the movies. So.
Exactly. You can sort of do your homework and be prepared for class.
Yeah, so it's a valuable resource. I hope people will check it out.
And I'm really excited about it. And it really kind of fits to more what my kind of background and knowledge and passions are kind of connected to. But James, quickly, let's do our last story that's a bit of a positive story. And of course, it's from foodworldorder.com. Major grocer Albertsons getting rid of self-checkout lanes. One of the nation's major grocery store chains is eliminating self-checkout lanes in an effort to encourage more human contact with its customers. Albertsons LLC, which operates 217 stores in 7 western and southern states, including here in Oregon, will eliminate all self-checkout lanes in the 100 stores that have them and will replace them with standard or express lanes, a spokeswoman said. We just want the opportunity to talk to customers more, Albertsons spokeswoman Christine Wilcox said. That's the driving motivation. Although she goes on to mention what I think is the heart of the story here. Wilcox said the replacement of automated checkout lanes with human-operated lanes likely would mean more hours available for employees to work. The move marks a surprising step back from a trend that began about a decade ago when supermarkets began installing self-checkout lanes, touting them as a solution to long lines. Now, some grocery chains are questioning whether they really are good for business. James, and I'll ask you again, do you guys have these type of self-checkout lanes in Japan?
Not where I am, at any rate. No, it's a very customer service-oriented society in Japan, so that type of idea would be maybe not catch on quite so well here. But I like this story because it shows exactly the type of point that we're trying to hammer home week after week, usually on food-related stories, which is that a lot of these things seem inevitable, and you and I and a lot of people out there play into that. We have that mindset that these things are coming down the pike and there's nothing can be done, and sometimes we get trapped in that stuff. Style of thinking, and it happens with cloud computing, or it happens with, you know, automation of the cashless society and things like that, and we think it's coming, and here it is, and here's this story showing it, and we get trapped in that mentality. But the point is, as always, is that we vote with our dollars, we vote with our pocketbooks, we refuse to shop at places that will eliminate the human element from the checkout and things like that. And if people stand up and get on their hind legs and start saying no to these things, they will fall. And this is just another example of that. Another example going on in Canada, it's completely unrelated, but in Canada they've been talking about putting in a metered internet so that you pay per gigabyte of download or whatever, and it's going to jack up rates immensely. And the CRTC, basically the Canadian equivalent of the FCC, was saying that this is going to be the way it is. Hundreds of thousands of Canadians signed a petition, and they actually forced hearings on the matter, and now parliamentarians are standing up and saying, oh, we agree, you shouldn't have to do this. So again, people can stand up and make a difference.
We are totally out of time. I thank you so much. I hope you enjoy your break and you will be back better than ever. Thanks so much.
That's right. See you in mid-August.